Welcome to All Things Marine, Hawaii's thought-provoking show dedicated to marine science and ocean conservation. All Things Marine, brought to you by Kosi Island Earth and the University of Hawaii, Hawaii Institute of Marine Biology. And now, here's your host, the marine science gal, Carly Weiner.
Aloha! I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal, and today we are going to connect live with Schmidt Ocean Institute's research vessel Falkor, currently sailing from Honolulu to Portland. On this special episode, we will talk to several scientists about ocean particles. Yes, that's right, the microscopic organisms and materials that you don't really think about when you are in the water. These particles, mostly focusing on phytoplankton, are the focus of the research that the scientists are doing. A very important life source for the entire ocean. With us today is NASA scientist and chief scientist of the expedition, Dr. Ivana Sentinich, as well as Dr. Stephanie Ooze, Dr. Wayne Slade, and Dr. Meg Estapa. We've got lots to cover, so let's go live right now to the Falkor and talk first with Ivana. Dr. Sentinich is a phytoplankton ecologist with the Ocean Ecology Lab at NASA. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Carly. Thank you so much. It's great to be live at part of the All Things Marine radio show.
Well, we're so happy to have you and to take a few moments out of your really busy day looking at phytoplankton. So first, why don't you tell us where you are right now and how things are going on board?
So we are currently off the coast of beautiful California, a little bit north of Monterey. Actually, we're just passing Monterey. It's a beautiful day. And we have just finished our CTD cast, where we collected some seawater, and we did a profile to measure ocean color, and we're heading north towards Portland.
That sounds excellent. And how are the seas treating you today?
Today's a beautiful day. We had some rough patches, but we managed to, you know, get through them, and everything worked out great. So today is a really beautiful day. We're really enjoying the sunshine.
Excellent. And you guys are doing so much on board, and I can't wait to talk a lot about it. But first, what gave you the idea to apply for this cruise?
So the whole idea about the application for this cruise actually came from my colleague, Wayne Slade. He started developing a really cool instrument that can measure the distribution, the size of the particles in the ocean. And we started thinking, oh, that's a great instrument, but we should find a way to test it. And so there was pretty much a time when the call for the Falkor ship time came just in our email inbox. And we're like, okay, let's try to write a pre-proposal that went through, and then wrote a proposal that went through, and then we just packed our stuff and got on a ship. And here we are.
So for those of us that don't do science on board a ship, why is it so important to get this ship time? I mean, what does this time on board offer you?
Well, getting ship time is really important for us because, it allows this connection to the ocean. For example, for my research, I very often use remote sensing satellites. The satellites, they're measuring ocean color. But every now and every so often, we really actually have to go and measure in the sea what are these things that we see from the sky. And ship time is hard to get, especially if you're working for NASA. So this is really a great opportunity because we did have funding to do the research, but we just didn't have an opportunity to get some sea time. So this was like really a match made in heaven for us.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, most people, when you ask them what do they think about when they think of NASA, they think of space. But actually, you guys are doing quite a lot of ocean work and definitely interested in the work that you're doing on board. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so as I said previously, the whole idea about doing this cruise and collaborating with Falkor came from our colleague Wayne. He's going to be talking a little bit more about it, but it kind of comes around the idea of particles in the ocean. So, I mean, ocean is, of course, water, but except for the water, there's many, many particles in this oceanic water. They're changing the color of the ocean. And this is something that we can see from space. If we can make a connection between the types of particles that we see in the ocean and the ocean color, then we can use this ocean color images that we can collect from satellites to interpret processes in the ocean. So the most important particles in the ocean are phytoplankton. These are microscopic plant-like organisms that, similar to plants on land, produce oxygen. They're the base of marine food web because through the process of photosynthesis, they sequester carbon dioxide and produce sugars through which they feed the rest of the marine food web. So we really, really know how many of them there is in the ocean and how are they distributed throughout the ocean. So that's pretty much the focus. We really want to understand how does the presence of different particles, specifically different types of phytoplankton, modify the ocean color, and what impact does that have on carbon cycle and life in the ocean.
So for those of us who really haven't had an experience with phytoplankton or particles, and I'm sure everyone has in some form or another and just not known it, what kind of phytoplankton are you seeing, or can you describe what some of the phytoplankton look like that you're working with?
Yes, I'm more than happy to describe phytoplankton because I really, really like phytoplankton. So means first, if people want to see the images of the phytoplankton, we've been posting a lot of blogs on the Schmidt Ocean Institute website, so you're more than welcome to go there and see the images that we're actually seeing. But I'll try to use my words to explain the beauty. So when we started from Hawaii, we entered into the part of the ocean, it's kind of like more like a desert, the ocean. Think about it. It's really not, there's not too much phytoplankton in there. So these are smaller particles that kind of like try to get along with a little bit what they have in that ocean, because that ocean is not abundant with nutrients, these chemical elements that they need to survive. So that we think about them as recyclers. They come in many different shapes and forms, and there's really not too many of them. So they're kind of like, I don't know, roundish, and they have some kind of like hair thingies on them, and it's kind of hard to explain them. Once we got here closer to the California coast, the whole story completely changed. We just came with this really highly productive and phytoplankton abundant area, and there was many, many different types of phytoplankton that we encountered. One of many of those were diatoms. These are phytoplankton that are really important for the carbon cycle because they're big, and when they appear in large numbers, they actually kind of provide food for the rest of the food web, and they also really successfully kind of clump up together in these aggregates, and then they fall down through the water column and export this carbon. So there's many of them here. They're kind of like live in a glass cage, and they form these beautiful, beautiful, very intricate structures. And there's many, 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 much, many more than we encountered in Hawaii. So it's a completely different world. Just imagine like walking from Mexico all the way to Seattle. You're going to go through deserts all the way to these beautiful deep forests. And that's pretty much what we're seeing now, this gorgeous forest of the phytoplankton.
That's an amazing visualization. I love that, the gorgeous forests of the phytoplankton oceans. And definitely have more of appreciation of diatoms after following the cruise. So you say particles and mostly phytoplankton. What are the other particles? What is that material besides phytoplankton?
Yeah, so in ocean we find many different types of particles. In oceans, similar to the plants on the land, when they die, they kind of become like dead leaves. And we call these things detritus. These are all different organic particles. They're just like floating around in the ocean, but they're dead. When you come closer to the shore, you start encountering different types of particles. You start encountering sediment and minerals that can be resuspended from the bottom of the ocean or brought into the ocean by rivers, for example. We also start encountering different particles, organic particles, so pieces actually of leaves that came from the shore. There are different other parts of the ocean that we don't consider particles but can modify the color of the ocean, like different organic matter, similar to the like tea, when you make a tea, so like you steep leaves and then they kind of release the tea. That's what happens in the ocean. Organic material kind of steeps in the water and releases this color. And it also modifies the color of the ocean. Although it's not particles, it's really important for us. So we studied that one as well.
So when you swallow some ocean water, you're not just swallowing water, you're swallowing lots of other things along with it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't touch it at all on zooplankton because I really don't like them because they eat my phytoplankton. But I mean, they're also important. They're like the little animals of the ocean. And many fish, actually, in their larval stage, are part of this planktonic kingdom. So it's all this miniature like world that exists out there when, yeah, if you swallow some water, oceanic water, you're going to be swallowing lots of life with it and other particles.
And the phytoplankton helped the zooplankton who helped the fish, so it's all important. So now how does the phytoplankton and the particles that you're studying relate to space? I know you guys work with NASA and you're working on a new satellite that's going to help with this. Can you share a little bit more about how these two correlate?
Yes, definitely. So, you know, as many people saying, NASA does space, and Earth is part of the space. So understanding the processes on Earth will allow us to, know better things about Earth, but also learn about how can we study the space in a better way. One of the important aspects of Earth is ocean. It covers 71% of the surface, so we really want to know much more about it. The oceans are changing, and we really have to have good tools and hands to study the changing oceans and the processes in that ocean. And the best way to study it is actually look at the ocean from the satellites. Satellites go around the Earth every day and offer us this tremendous view of the Earth because pretty much every day we have an image of the surface of the ocean every day. So it allows us to continuously observe changes. And the way we see that is by looking at the ocean color. Again, the color of the ocean is not only blue, it can come in many different colors, and that's highly dependent on the types of particles we see in the ocean. In open ocean, dominant particles are phytoplankton, these microscopic plant-like organisms. They come in many different shapes and sizes, as I said before, and that shape and size will determine the way that they impact the ocean color. So that's what we're trying to do. Currently, ocean color satellites cannot tell us a lot. They can tell us that there's phytoplankton and how much of the phytoplankton is there in the ocean. And PACE, new ocean color satellites, called PACE is short for Plankton Aerosol Cloud and Ocean Ecosystem Mission, that new satellite is going to actually be able to see in a much better, much more precise way what different types of phytoplankton are we seeing in the ocean. So we're developing that technology already in NASA, and what this cruise we hope is going to allow us to collect the data that in future we can use to inform new mathematical ways to study these different types of phytoplankton from space.
And so when would this new satellite be ready to go? I mean, will we be able to see the results of this in the near future?
Well, the satellite, the base, is about to be launched and currently in August 2022. If nothing changed while I was on a cruise. So there's still some time to go. You know, building a satellite, everybody knows, when, SpaceX launches a satellite, and everybody's like, woo! But there's really lots of work to get to that point.
Sure.
So we are actually in that process of working towards, getting to launch this satellite. And having data sets such as this one that we collected in Falkor is really, really important for us. It's really informative so we can start planning next ocean color missions, kind of invest in development of different algorithms that can actually facilitate future work and performance of space. I'm just hoping that I'm going to be able to write my name on the rocket. So I'm planning to stick around until the satellites get launched.
Well, that's amazing to get a behind-the-scenes look at how that developed and what kind of information you need to go into that. You think about a satellite as just being, you build the satellite and then you launch it. You don't think about all the data and research and other protocols that go into it before it gets launched. So very cool stuff. So tell me, the satellite and the phytoplankton work that you're doing on board, it's going to help to better understand the ocean, and you've alluded to diatoms helping with sinking carbon and a changing ocean, but really, why should people care about these particles, and how does that affect us here on the islands here in Hawaii or in the land anywhere else?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Sometimes when you talk about, sequestration of carbon, it's kind of like not really something that person can relate to, although it's really important. Phytoplankton by drawing down carbon from the atmosphere, controls the climate. But the aspects are much closer to us. There's lots of aspects of phytoplankton that impact our life right away. So primarily, they make oxygen, and we breathe oxygen, so that's cool. That's awesome that they're around. But then an important thing that most of the people think about, especially in Hawaii, is fisheries. Fish and as many other forms of life in the ocean are dependent on presence of the phytoplankton. That's where all the source of the oceanic food comes from. Also, maybe not so much in Hawaii, but for example, here in coastal California, phytoplankton can go rogue. It can go rabid on us. And sometimes you get these blooms of phytoplankton, this proliferation of the number of phytoplankton that can produce toxins. And the accumulation of the toxins in the ocean will impact fisheries, aquaculture, and, other marine life. For example, the story about Hitchcock's movie Birds says that it was inspired by the situation where Hitchcock was walking down the pretty much somewhere close here in California, and he saw these birds kind of being crazed and attacking people and attacking things. And we do believe that these birds that Hitchcock has seen that inspired him to make a movie actually ate lots of fish that contained domoic acid, which is a toxin that is produced by algae blooming here offshore California. So, I mean, not only it impacts the selection of your movies, but it will impact the selection of the food that you're going to get, and, you know, and the fact that will birds fly around your car or not. So there's so many different aspects, important aspects about phytoplankton. And, you know, by building these new tools, like, you know, having satellites such as Space up in the sky, we hope that we're going to be able to distinguish that special evil phytoplankton for other one, and then give out warnings earlier to the, you know, local population, fisheries, and policymakers to make, you know, important changes in the way that they fish or, you know, grow aquaculture so they can, you know, prevent a detrimental effect on humans and local ecosystems.
Well, I'd say this is pretty critical information. So as we're developing the satellite and getting new information about our oceans, where is the current information coming from or the information we've gotten to this point?
So, and I assume by that question you're meaning from the Ocean Color satellite. So we have current Ocean Color satellites. We had Ocean Color satellites for 20 years now, if not longer. And this information is really important. But as I said previously, Ocean Color satellites offer us kind of limited view. Just imagine, you know, the camera that you had on cell phone maybe 8 years ago versus the camera that you have on your cell phone right now. That's the difference between current Ocean Color satellites and base. Base is going to give us much better resolution. But current Ocean Color satellites are amazing just because this 20 years gave us an unprecedented record of the phytoplankton, so the biomass of these really important microscopic plant-like organisms in the ocean. And we know we can observe the changes over a long period of time. We know how the ocean breathes, and we know how the ocean changes. So that's where we are right now. We can see how much phytoplankton there is, how are they changing. We really don't know how many different types and which different types prevail in different types of the ocean. We don't know that, and PACE hopefully is going to give us that information.
Well, we're excited for PACE version 2022. That will be excellent. It's a great analogy. So my last question is, there's so many different projects going on the cruise right now related to phytoplankton and particles and different scientists focusing on different things. As the chief scientist, how do you keep track of it all, and how are they all connecting together?
I was just telling somebody this morning that, you know, when I went on a research cruise, I was a grad student, and I was looking at this crazed chief scientist who was never sleeping, and he was doing all these things, and I was like, I'm never going to be like that. And I'm pretty much not sleeping too much and really trying to work really hard to, you know, accommodate all this science. We are all connected by the phytoplankton. All of us are looking at the different aspects of the phytoplankton. Some of us are looking from above, some are looking from the side in a way, and some are looking from below, as you're going to hear later on by my colleagues. And really what the role of chief scientist is to kind of listen to all of them and kind of try to offer them a platform where they can all collaborate. So by doing so, you not do not get to sleep a lot, but, you know, this is what we do for science. Woohoo! So when I come home, I'll sleep, I hope.
Well, we hope you get some sleep soon. Thank you so much, Ivana, for making some time to talk to us today. I know how hectic ship life is and how important the work is that you guys are doing. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break, but we are going to connect back with Falkor in just a few minutes and learn more about phytoplankton.
Looking, firing across the middle. Wow, what a grab in traffic. Larson really had defenders hanging all over, but somehow he comes up with the football.
On the football field, you've got to stay focused and not get distracted.
NFL Hall of Famer and President and CEO of CTIA, the Wireless Association, Steve Largent.
The same is true on the road. So before your wireless phone becomes a distraction, take a timeout for safety. Place your phone in easy reach before you leave. Never take notes or look up a phone number while you're driving. In bad weather or traffic, call later. Dial sensibly and use a hands-free device. You know, your wireless phone can be your best safety tool to call for help, stop a crime, or help someone in need. However you use it, remember, with wireless, safety is your call.
The wireless industry reminds you to drive safely. For more information, visit www.wirelesssafety.org.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. Today we are learning all about phytoplankton and particles in our ocean, and why should we care about this amazing system? With us now is Dr. Wayne Slade. Wayne is an oceanographer and engineer interested in understanding particles in the coastal and open oceans using new technologies, and is part of the crew on board Falkor today. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carly. Thanks for having me.
And thank you. We appreciate you taking some time from your research. And we just talked to Ivana, and she explained to us a little bit about the particles making up the ocean. But I know we also hear in some of the blogs and some of the scientists refer to small debris or marine snow. Now, is that what we're seeing when we're swimming in the ocean or taking a picture in the ocean, all those sort of white dots that in the water?
Yeah, so that's, I think, what we would typically call marine snow. And interestingly enough, when you're diving and taking pictures like that, a lot of what you're actually seeing is poop and the small creatures like zooplankton that are eating even smaller microscopic organisms like the phytoplankton that Ivana talked about a lot, and then, you know, pooping them out. So you're also seeing aggregates of the individual phytoplankton and all of the different detritus and particles that Ivana was mentioning that stick together.
And so,
but on top of that, there's a whole like world of microbes that Ivana was talking about that you can't see like you can see the marine snow, but they're still changing how the water looks in terms of color.
Gotcha. And so you're working with some of these smaller microscopic organisms that you can't see with the naked eye. Is that correct?
Indeed. Yes.
And so how do you work with them? I know you're bringing new technologies to study marine snow and other types of particles. Tell us a little bit about the new work that you're doing.
Well, in a lot of cases, when we're trying to develop these new technologies, what we're doing is borrowing existing methods and technologies that are used to make measurements in well-controlled lab conditions back on land, and we're figuring out how to either use that technology underwater or in a hectic, really chaotic lab environment like you have on an ocean research ship. For example, the flow cytometry and some of the microscopy and genomic techniques that are used on this cruise are rooted in medical and other sorts of technology used for counting and analyzing cells. The particle sizing instruments that I work with a lot and I'm working with on this cruise were actually developed for industry, but it really doesn't matter if you're measuring cement powders or phytoplankton. The basic physics behind how the light is scattered and absorbed is the same, so we can sort of borrow these sorts of technologies.
So now you mentioned light. How are you using light to study these small particles or organisms?
Basically, you try to figure out how things in the seawater affect the light, and then you use different approaches to measure that light. The stuff in the water, all the particles that Ivana's talked about and that we're also concerned with, and the dissolved materials that she hinted towards, these are all different things that change the light in characteristic ways. For example, how the chlorophyll and phytoplankton or tree leaves absorb blue and red components of sunlight and then reflect the green back to our eyes. We can actually measure the amount of green light that's reflected and use that to estimate how much chlorophyll is in the seawater. In some cases, like ocean color, we use the sunlight as our light source. And sometimes we use our own light source, like LEDs or lasers, and look at how the seawater affects those light sources. For example, in my instruments, I shine a laser into my sample and measure how that laser light is scattered by particles that are suspended in the seawater.
So it sounds like a pretty amazing time on board in terms of the science that you're doing. I mean, we're talking lasers and LED lights and really cool collections of seawater from the ocean. Can you walk us through, you know, so we can better visualize what your day looks like in terms of how you're collecting your samples and what you do with it?
What my day looks like? Well, my day is sort of the night. I pulled that shift. I think, you know, what my sensors tend to do is a little bit more abstract. So I measure just the scattering that's coming off the samples and accumulate this data, just raw sorts of digital numbers coming off detectors, and process those using some mathematical algorithms to estimate the concentration of different particle sizes. And so during a cruise like this, I tend to get kind of jealous of the scientists that have microscope images and pretty pictures, and I get jealous, but then I realize that I can actually, you know, see these broader trends and high-resolution features, and kind of the most exciting thing for me is to see how all of these different methods compare with each other, and that's going to be one of the big focuses of our work after the cruise.
Yeah, it will be really interesting to see how they all connect together. And I know you're using some new instruments on this cruise. Can you tell us a little bit how you're using them and testing them and what process you go through before it becomes an established tool that you would use on future particle cruises?
Sure, yeah. I think one of the keys when you're dealing with a new instrument is you have to realize that it's probably not going to work like you expected it to work when you were back in the laboratory. So, you know, I get to deal with that the first couple of weeks of the cruise and then come to the realization that it might be more limited than I had expected. But that's all part of the development process, and it's why we do this out here and test with lots of other scientists to try to understand how the instruments work and really get a good feeling for how to make it work better and package it into something that I can then provide to other scientists to make measurements. Basically, the system I brought out here is designed to measure the concentration of different sizes of particles in the surface ocean. It's automated, and it samples from the continuous seawater flow that we're pumping on board continuously. It works by shining a laser into the seawater sample, and there are detectors arranged around the sample that measure how the light is scattered by the particles in the seawater. Basically, smaller particles tend to scatter really evenly in all directions, while the bigger particles scatter more forward, sort of just deflecting the laser beam. And I can detect how that light is scattered and use those measurements to estimate the particle sizes. And so with this instrument, I can get kind of a broad picture of particle sizes from the smallest phytoplankton to maybe small to medium-sized zooplankton.
And why do we care about the particle sizes?
Why do we care about the particle
sizes? Yeah, why do we care if one of them's bigger or smaller?
Well, like Ivana was sort of talking about, the smaller particles will tend to be these kind of recycled particles in some environments, or they'll be consumed by larger particles like zooplankton that will then move the carbon through the biological pump and potentially move it out of the surface ocean. So, I mean, some of this is still being actively researched as far as how particle size affects the carbon cycle. And so that's actually one of the things I think you'll hear from one of my colleagues next.
And so these new tools that you're working with on board, can we do this already with other methods, or is this the first time that we're able to differentiate between particle sizes?
No, I don't think it's the first time we can differentiate between particle sizes, but the tools that I'm developing and the instruments that I've put together for this cruise are, I think, more efficient would be a way to put it. We can sample with these instruments much faster, you know, several samples per minute, compared with other techniques like microscopy, where you might only get a few samples per day, or other benchtop systems where you have to manually introduce a sample to the instrument. So I think the automation and the ability to get a lot of size distributions while you're on the cruise is the advantage of the instrument.
And when you've been looking at the samples with the new instruments, is there anything you've collected or seen so far that's been surprising to you?
Well, other than bubbles, nothing too terribly surprising. I've seen a lot of shifts in particle concentration and some shifts in particle size distribution that still need to be calibrated back in the lab after the cruise. But it's pretty interesting to see how rapidly some of these things changes. You know, you think of the ocean as this big sort of homogeneous blob of water, but it's when you really, even in the open ocean, you can see really rapid changes in properties and particles. So it's this patchiness is kind of interesting, of interest to me.
Hmm. Excellent. And so you mentioned further steps after the cruise. And a lot of times I think, you know, we get excited about these ocean expeditions, but you don't think about what happens afterwards. So walk us through, after the cruise is done, besides catching up on sleep, what comes next?
Catching up on sleep, catching up on email, catching up on data analysis. There'll be a lot of additional lab validation of using the same sensor, and then probably iterating on that, on those lab tests to try to improve the sensor. And then at the same time, work with colleagues to try to link the samples that I've been taking with the measurements they've been making, and try to understand how my measurements of size compares to their measurements of size.
So for you, what's the most rewarding part of this work? I mean, you're doing something that not, you know, everybody can imagine or thinks about on their day-to-day basis. What for you is so special about this expedition and the type of work that you do?
Well, other than just sort of the basic engineering aspects that I enjoy, I think what I really like about this cruise is that as oceanographers, we use ocean color data a lot because it gives us a really amazing view of the ocean. Like Ivana said, from small features all the way up to the global ocean, we get daily pictures of the global ocean, and we can compare features over days or weeks or seasons or even decades. And what I really find rewarding about this cruise in particular is that I think most everybody on the cruise is really interested in expanding what we can do with ocean color, with sensors like Ivana was talking about with PACE, for example. So I think what's really rewarding is that this can help us learn how to apply new algorithms to this data to address and better understand societal problems like climate change and coastal water quality.
Excellent. And finally, is there anything else that you want to share about the work that you're doing or any recommendations you have if people want to learn more? Where should they go or what should they look up if they want to better understand ocean particles and how color is helping us to understand those?
I think an amazing place to start is with the Schmidt Ocean Institute and the NASA Earth blogs that have been during this cruise. This is like nothing I've ever seen. This has given an amazing view into what we do out here at sea. And, I mean, that's a fantastic place to start. And beyond that, just look into STEM programs and local institutes, museums, and so on that have opportunities to learn more about some of the sensors and systems that we use.
Excellent. Well, we're really excited to learn more about your work and to see how the rest of the cruise turns out. So thank you so much for taking time to connect with us, Wayne. We're going to take a very quick break, and when we come back, we're going to learn more about marine phytoplankton and work at sea.
You mean I could have diabetes and not even know it?
Then why would I want to know?
Heart disease, amputations, stroke, blindness can all be caused by diabetes. So it's critical that you know. If you're over 45, you don't exercise, and you're overweight, you're at risk. But a simple blood test can detect the problem, and with early treatment, you can prevent the devastating effects of diabetes. Call the American Diabetes Association at 1-800-DIABETES. Don't be blind to diabetes.
Mom?
Dad?
How long should I wait for you?
Mom?
If I'm at soccer practice.
What if something happens? Will you come get me?
There's no reason not to have a plan in case of a terrorist attack.
Mom, if you're not home,
should we go to the neighbor's house?
And some extremely good reasons why you should.
Can you tell me?
Everybody should have a plan. Take 5 minutes to talk about where you'll meet and how you'll get in touch with each other in an emergency. For other things you can do to be prepared, visit www.ready.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, I'm Carly Weiner, your marine science gal. We continue our discussion about working at sea, investigating particles and phytoplankton. With us now is Dr. Meg Estapa, an assistant professor of geosciences at Skidmore College in New York and a biogeochemical oceanographer. Welcome to the show, Meg.
Hi, Carly. Thanks.
Thank you for taking some time. We're having so much fun talking to all of you at sea right now. It's amazing the clarity, actually. I'm quite impressed with the connection. It's so great being so far away and being able to connect. So we've heard a little bit about what's been going on so far. How about your work? I'd love to hear from your perspective about what you've been looking at on this expedition.
Okay. So I have been studying the particles in the ocean that are sinking out of the surface ocean and into the dark, deep part of the ocean, which is actually most of the ocean's volume. So Ivana and Wayne have talked a little bit about the particles and phytoplankton that we mostly find in the upper 100 meters or 300 to 400 feet of the ocean. The ocean is actually, on average, 4,000 meters deep. And so an important role that phytoplankton and ocean animals and plants ecosystems play in global climate is that they actually deliver carbon from the atmosphere and the surface ocean into the deep water. And the way that this happens, Ivana and Wayne have already alluded to, but if you think about plankton that live in surface water, eventually they die or they excrete waste products. And like leaves falling from trees in the autumn, they sink down into the deep water. And that actually carries carbon away from the atmosphere and into the ocean, to the deep ocean. So what I'm studying are these particles specifically that are sinking into deep water. So in the sometimes we call that the twilight zone of the ocean.
So how deep is this twilight zone that you're looking at?
We sometimes call the twilight zone the depths in the ocean that extend from roughly 100 meters down to 1,000 meters. So this is the part of the ocean where if you are maybe an animal or something that likes to eat dead stuff or sinking stuff, you'll hang out in those depths to catch the slow rain of sinking detritus that comes out of the surface ocean.
Excellent. So we're talking about deeper areas, and how are you going about extracting your phytoplankton and particles from these depths? I mean, you're obviously not jumping in the water and collecting it by hand.
No, definitely not. Definitely looking deeper down. The tools that I've been using on this cruise are called neutrally buoyant sediment traps. So a sediment trap in the ocean is kind of like a rain gauge. It's basically a cylindrical collector that you put out in the ocean and you leave it there for a few days and it collects whatever happens to fall into it. The kind of sediment trap that I'm using is special because it's autonomous, which means we put it over the side and it senses what depth it's at and sinks down to whatever pre-programmed collection depth I've told it to go to, and it sits there, it drifts along and collects, and then it rises back up to the surface and transmits its GPS position to the ship so we can go get it. So the neutrally buoyant sediment traps that I'm using operate that way. Those particular traps are also, we've kind of tricked them out with some extra fancy things on this particular cruise. So we've got optical sensors on them that are telling us something about the particle sinking rate that we can hopefully take those sensors and put them on, for instance, profiling floats that operate completely independently of ships in the future. So we can get more measurements of how many particles are sinking out of the upper ocean. And we also are putting special collectors in our sediment traps that let us bring sinking particles back up to the ship, and then we're measuring their DNA, and we're taking careful images of them. So we can also connect the color and the size of the particles that we're getting in the deep ocean back up to what was coming out of what we've been detecting in the surface ocean with all of the tools already discussed.
That's amazing.
Actually.
Now, those sediment traps, I'm sure, have created a little bit of excitement on board, or so I've read through the blogs. Can you tell us about some of the fascinating and exciting things that go through those collection processes?
A lot of the excitement around the sediment traps that you've maybe read about on the blog so far is just that they are rather big devices, and we have to let them go from the ship for days at a time. So there's a little bit of sort of waiting with bated breath until our gear comes back and we can get our samples back and start to process them and learn a little bit about what was going on in the ocean over those few days that everything was deployed. So that can be a great source of excitement, especially when the weather is rough or there are, I think we had one of our so anyway, so the technology that we're deploying is exciting in that sense.
Well, who says there's no dramatic tension in science?
There's always a little bit.
Absolutely. And so once you are collecting and imaging these samples, I mean, how many different types of phytoplankton or particles are you looking at or seeing? Can you even put a number on that?
So we see a really big array of different kinds of particles. So as Ivana mentioned, we've transited on the cruise so far from the oligotrophic or sort of the open ocean near Hawaii, where there's not a whole lot of productivity, not so many particles sinking out. The plankton that live in that part of the ocean are pretty efficient at recycling everything that grows up there. So there's very little sinking out. And we've moved all the way into the coastal California current, where we have a great diversity of particles that are sinking out of the surface ocean. They tend to be made up of, we can sometimes see single cells, so single organisms that have died and are sinking down. We catch them in our traps. We also see aggregates of phytoplankton. So some kinds of phytoplankton, when they're senescing or when they die, they stick together into these clumps, and they get bigger, and that makes them sink faster. So we see those. We also see the waste products or fecal pellets of zooplankton, which are microscopic animals that eat the phytoplankton. Those also have a really important role in taking phytoplankton and repackaging them into these larger things that are really the drivers that are pulling a lot of carbon out into the deep water.
Excellent. And, you know, it's clear that the capabilities are always evolving for being able to study our ocean. How do these autonomous sediment traps advance the way that you can study the ocean? Has this helped and changed in a lot of ways?
So the autonomous sediment traps are a technology that's been around for a little while, and they're helpful because they eliminate some of the it makes it really easy to collect sort of gently settling particles or ones that are wafting around slowly in the ocean, so they don't get spun out of an eddy in the top of the trap or something like that. So it makes it a better sample collection process. And then definitely putting the different kinds of collectors in the sediment traps and using the optical sensors we started attaching to our sediment traps has really... it's giving us a new dimension, a new way of looking at these particles that we're collecting. And hopefully, in the future, especially with the optical sensors, those are going to allow us to really broaden the time and space coverage that we have for these sinking particle measurements in the ocean. Right now, there just aren't that many. Every time you want to make a measurement of sinking particle flux in the upper ocean, you have to send a ship out. And so we're pretty data limited in that sense.
Mm-hmm. And there's so much going on this particular expedition, all revolving around phytoplankton. For you, what's making this cruise unique or different to other types of field work you've done before?
Well, that's a good question. This particular cruise, I think, is fantastic because it includes oceanographers who study all different types and different aspects of this phytoplankton, upper ocean ecosystems, and the ocean carbon cycle. So we have a lot of biological oceanographers on board, but also physical oceanographers. I'm a chemical oceanographer, engineers. So we have a really interdisciplinary view of the processes that are going on. And we're really pushing the boundaries, I think, of the kinds of measurements that we can make of these processes by having so many new tools and instruments all out here at the same time. We're also laying the foundation, I hope, for being able to measure and estimate some of these carbon cycling processes from future satellite observations. So we're trying to understand the biology that drives, for instance, sinking particles into the deep water, which we can't do right now, but in the future I think we might be able to. We need these kinds of detailed interdisciplinary measurements to do so, though.
Absolutely. And I think another piece that to me looks really unique about this expedition is that it's predominantly a female science party, and there's a lot of women in science working out there. How does that feel to be part of a team? That team?
Well, I would say actually it is definitely unique that it's a predominantly female science party, but one of the other even more unique and really nice things about this particular cruise is that everybody works so well together. We are mostly, I would say, sort of early to mid-career scientists who are all focused on the same problem. We bring really different perspectives. A lot of us are friends. So it's just a really great collaborative working environment. And so I think that's probably the most unique and good feeling part of this cruise.
Excellent. And I know you, as an educator, what will you take back to your students after the cruise? Is there new information or things that you'll share with your classes?
So one of the other hats that I wear, in addition to being an oceanographer researcher, is that I also do a lot of teaching. And my undergraduate students back at Skidmore College are in a sort of landlocked area. It's in upstate New York. So I have a lot of students who are really passionate about ocean science, but we don't have a lot of, it's not right there. The ocean isn't easy to access for us. So I often will bring back samples. I'll bring back definitely photos and videos and stories and lots of resources to sort of bring this field experience a little bit more close to my students. I'm also taking back samples to analyze, and I'll have some students that are involved in that as well.
That's fantastic. And so aside from sample analysis, what will be next for your research after the cruise?
Well, I think we're sort of at the forefront of bringing together such a broad array of tools to study the ocean carbon cycle and the way that phytoplankton interact with that. So definitely trying to do more of the sort of pushing these linkages with other disciplines in oceanography and testing new tools is important. Alongside the development of new tools for measuring sinking particles and what their compositions are, we also need to intercompare them and test them and characterize, you know, what are the uncertainties associated with all the new measurements we can make. So I have a project coming up where we're going to be trying to do a little bit more of that, try to do some testing and intercalibration. And I think another really exciting thing is sort of future satellite capabilities hopefully will let us do a much more detailed job of describing and predicting how the ocean biology drives the carbon cycle. So getting into connections where we can take these deep twilight zone measurements and connect them back to the view that we have from ocean color satellites in space is something that I hope I'll be able to do more of in my research in the future.
Well, we're definitely excited to see what comes out of this cruise and all your future research, Meg. This has been fantastic. I really appreciate you taking some time. I want to make sure we leave a few minutes to certainly speak with one of the other scientists on board, Dr. Stephanie Ouz. Stephanie is an oceanographer and coordinates communication for the PACE project at NASA's Space Flight Center. So, Stephanie, welcome. I'm glad we had some time to chat with you as well.
Hi, Carly. Thanks. Oh, thanks for having me.
Thank you for making some time. I know it's been a really busy cruise, and we've been able to talk to a bunch of the different scientists on board. I know you've been doing some of your own science, but also working with the communications team. What do you think are the most critical or groundbreaking aspects of this expedition?
Well, as the others have mentioned, Ivana and Wayne and Meg, the interdisciplinary nature of the cruise is really exciting. And, you know, the phytoplankton work and how we can take optical measurements that we hope to be able to use to better see things from satellites, as well as the carbon cycle work that's going on. Personally, for myself, this is really fantastic because I've been using ocean color in my research for a long time, as well as doing research in the tropical Pacific, but not this far north. So it's been really exciting for me, not only to see how all these instruments work and see the great science that's going on here, but also to experience the Pacific Ocean and see firsthand some of the processes that are going on in the ocean.
Yeah, can you describe some of the differences you've been experiencing and how physically, what's the environment been like during this cruise compared to places you worked elsewhere?
Yeah, well, I had been in the Atlantic on my last research cruise, and that was the Gulf Stream, and that was a pretty different environment. That's a fast-moving western boundary current. So here we started off from Hawaii, which doesn't have a whole lot of currents, and so we were able to see something called inertial oscillations, which was really exciting to me, that it was in the motion of that the wire walker traced during the time that it was left to drift on its own. And then we've come over to the California Current, which is on the eastern boundary, east side of the Pacific Ocean. So that's not as strong as something like the Gulf Stream, but it's associated with more productivity, and that's been, again, very interesting.
I think it's so fascinating, the different aspects of research on this cruise and how everybody's doing something so different. We talked to Wayne, and he mentioned, you know, he's working night shifts and looking more at general ocean particles. Walk us through, what are your days looking like on board, and how does a typical day look for you?
Well, I've been using the acoustic Doppler current profiler when it's available. As you know, the shipborne one, the hull-mounted one, had some problems, so they have a temporary one that we can only use when we're on station, when we're stopped and doing CTD measurements. But that helps. That gives us a sense of what the how the ocean is flowing underneath the ship, the horizontal currents, and the vertical structure of those horizontal currents. And then when I get back to the lab, I'll be using satellite data more. I've been looking at satellite data from here, but we have very low bandwidth here, and so I plan to do a lot more data analysis of remote sensing data sets when I get back on land and have better bandwidth and more computer resources.
There's always more work to be done, that's for sure. So what do the ocean currents that you're looking at with the EDCP, what does that tell you, and how does that relate to the particle work being done on board?
So the currents can give you an idea of how fast some water is moving and whether you have any kind of shear in the currents, whether you have any sort of rotation. All of those things can indicate whether there's processes that could be bringing nutrients up from below. So really the point of studying currents when you're looking at ocean biology is to get a sense for what could be bringing nutrients up, the nutrient pathways that could then fertilize phytoplankton blooms.
Excellent. And so what are some of the information that we can take from this cruise and apply to other research, or what will you do with your work that you're looking at after the cruise?
Well, that's a great question. So it's basically, in the past, my research has been very large scale, and so this is giving me a finer scale view. And of course, satellites have a very broad scale. And so when you go from looking at sort of point source measurements to satellite measurements, you have to you have a very detailed understanding of what's happening in one place, and then you kind of scale that up and you quantify the uncertainties in doing that. And you have what the cruise gives us is detailed depth information, which is, of course, missing from satellites. So that's a really important piece, and that's been very, very valuable here.
So where can people go to learn more about the expedition and some of the research that's been taking place?
Well, as Wayne mentioned, all the blogs and the whole Schmidt page about this expedition, that's been excellent, as well as the Earth Observatory. NASA's Earth Observatory is mirroring those blogs. We have on social media, we've been posting things, and then the PACE website, pace.gsfc.nasa.gov. It not only has a little bit of information about this field campaign, but also we have a really great research tool or a tool on there, an interactive tool to let people learn more about phytoplankton, some of their spectral characteristics, the optical properties that are being measured on this cruise. It's a great tool, so I highly recommend checking it out.
And there's some really cool lesson plans and activities as well, correct?
That's right. Yeah, we have an outreach activity that it's called What Color is the Ocean? And we use it at public events. We have different water samples that, you know, like tea, as has been mentioned earlier, that represents color dissolved organic matter. And we have a little simple spectrophotometer that people can make with a little magnetic snap kit, and then actually look at the what light is reflected or absorbed at the different bands, the red, green, or blue light. We shine a light through the different water samples, and then we can. So it's a simple activity that can convey the concepts that we use in ocean color remote sensing.
It's very cool, and I highly recommend people check it out if they want to experiment and learn a little more. Thank you so much, Stephanie, and to all of the scientists on board Falkor for taking some time today to share about this exciting work. We wish you a safe and productive rest of your cruise and look forward to finding out more about all the research once the cruise is completed. It is always important to remember the little things that count, so keep paying attention to those phytoplankton and particles. I'm Carly Weiner. Now get out there and enjoy our ocean planet.